This is Mitch Easter of Sneakers, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
Saturday, November 21st and Sunday, November 22nd, WGXC and Wave Farm have a special 24-hour broadcast for you to listen to. It's the 2020 edition of the Ragas Live Festival, featuring 60 musicians performing in locations around the world. It starts at 7 p.m. and is aired all night on WGXC 90.7 and Wave Farm's Standing Wave Radio until 8 a.m. Sunday morning, November 22nd, when we resume regular WGXC programming. But you continue to hear Ragas Live Festival online at WGXC.org and wavefarm.org in the Standing Wave Radio web stream. So tune in, 24 hours of ragas from around the world with performers such as Terry Riley, Brooklyn Raga Massive, Derek Gripper in South Africa, Amir El-Safar in Brooklyn, Prince Nepali in Nepal, Anantha Krishnan in India, and many, many others on a 24-hour broadcast from all over the planet from 7 p.m. November 21st to 7 p.m. November 22nd. Tune in to the entire broadcast on Waveform Standing Wave Radio and much of it Saturday night on WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Bindlestiff Family Circus of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. COVID-19 cases were again rising November 19th at an alarming rate. In Columbia County, there was another death announced November 19th, and 21 new cases were also reported there. In Greene County, six more cases were announced. Ulster County announced 74 new diagnoses of coronavirus with a positivity rate of 7.4%, the highest rate there since a 13.5% rate on May 11th. The City of Kingston and the Ulster County government are restricting access to their municipal buildings beginning November 23rd and lasting until January. Rensselaer County announced 40 new COVID-19 cases November 19th. There were 94 new cases announced in Albany County, where County Executive Dan McCoy complained that people were not being honest with health officials about how they caught the disease. He said, and I quote, "We just need you to be truthful. The information provided to us allows us to identify potential clusters or hotspots that help prevent people from getting sick or worse," end quote. New York State COVID-19 hospitalizations are now at the highest mark since June 8th. Governor Andrew Cuomo said November 19th that all these numbers will soon be higher. Cuomo warned, and I quote, "The virus is complicated, but you know what it's going to do. I will wager you if people are not extraordinarily diligent and act in a way they have never acted before, you will see a real spike," end quote. Sarah Tapton is reporting for Columbia Greene Media. The Greene County Legislature, November 18, approved the county's $112.6 million 2021 budget. The spending plan will stay relatively flat, increasing by $500,000. The budget calls for $2.5 million to be drawn from the county's reserve fund as well. The amount to be raised by taxes will remain at the 2020 level of $27.4 million, with 9 of the county's 14 towns seeing tax reductions, according to the budget document. Legislature Chairman Patrick Linger said, and I quote, "Our legislators and county leaders have done an excellent job holding the line on expenses and continuing to provide essential services during a quite challenging time," end quote. Greene County Administrator Sean Groden said, and I quote, "We've delivered a very conservative budget to provide excellent value to our taxpayers," end quote. At the end of the year, the county is projected to have $49.5 million of debt, with $38 million coming from the new Greene County Jail project. Sales tax revenue is projected to increase by $500,000 in the 2021 budget to $32.7 million. Groden said, and I quote, "The phenomena for sales tax is that the mall may have been closed, but people are still buying their sneakers. They're just doing it online," end quote. He noted that people may be changing the way they shop and how they shop, but they are still shopping. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. William J. Kimball and Mike Stribble are reporting for the Daily Freeman. The State Department of Public Service, November 19th, called for Central Hudson Gas and Electric Corp. to be fined $16 million for violations related to the recovery from Tropical Storm Isaiah in August. The department also recommended fines of $102 million for New York City-based Con Edison and $19 million for Orange and Rockland Utilities related to the same recovery. The utilities were warned about 2 weeks after the storm that steep fines were possible. Governor Andrew Cuomo said during a conference call with reporters, the proposed Central Hudson fine is the result of 32 separate violations related to power outages that lasted from August 4th until August 8th. Con Edison was cited for 33 violations and O&R for 38. All three companies will have the opportunity to dispute the recommended fines. The Department of Public Service said in a 46-page report that Isaiah caused 116,000 customers of Central Hudson to lose power. The utility serves a total of about 306,000 customers in eight New York counties, including Dutchess, Ulster, Greene, and Columbia. The report said Con Edison had 330,000 outages and O&R had 189,000. The report said Central Hudson and the other two utilities did not have enough personnel to make repairs, take calls from customers, and provide outage and repair updates online. State investigators also said preparation for Isaiah by all three utilities were based on a misreading of the storm's track, resulting in requests for outside assistance not being made until the storm was about to hit the area. And you can read the full story in the Daily Freeman. Emily Fago is reporting for the Legislative Gazette. New legislation has been signed into law last week that will make it easier for state residents to cancel memberships, escape confusing service plans, and unsubscribe from misleading subscriptions. New York will join 25 other states with some form of regulation to protect against deceptive agreements by businesses. As a result, New Yorkers will no longer be responsible for unscrambling the fine print on sales offers to determine whether or not they are being lured into a misleading agreement. Governor Andrew Cuomo last week signed the consumer protection legislation into law. Canceling subscriptions and memberships in person, as some agreements previously required, is no longer just a hassle, but a public health hazard due to COVID-19. Also of concern are the number of incidents of consumers being locked into automatic renewal under false pretenses. The new law will require businesses to be transparent with their contracts, automatic renewal offers, and continuous service plans, and allow New Yorkers to cancel subscription services with ease. The legislation will take effect February 9, 2021, exactly 90 days after Cuomo signed it into law. And you can read more in the Legislative Gazette. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, November 20th. 40s on the thermometers across the board this morning with a seasonably nice day in store. As the day goes on, cloud cover drops and temperatures rise to 57 degrees at 2 p.m. Winds will be brisk, reaching 10 miles per hour, so be sure to bring a jacket and don't forget those sunglasses. Overnight, it's relatively mild, reaching 41 degrees before dawn tomorrow. Another seasonably nice day with a high of 52 and a light breeze. Sunday will start around 30 and make it to 43 in the afternoon with a side of light rain. The next high tides will be at 7 a.m. and at 7:17 p.m. this evening. Low tides will be at 1:02 a.m. and at 1:11 p.m. Sunset today will be at 4:16 and sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:54 a.m. Looking way up, we see two near-Earth objects are expected today, the largest of which is 38 meters wide, pretty much a harmless rock. Solar wind speed is currently 375 kilometers per second at 5.7 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3. Quiet. The current sunspot number is 11, and this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Carrie and Donald Gardner of Athens, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You are listening to Transmission Arts Programming on WGXC 90.7 FM.
It was the year of our Lord, 2020. The same year a flattened Earth sojourned a record 694 days round a yellow star. It was the year a young man, wizened beyond his years by mafia trials, scotch, and motorboating, answered his nation's call for one final, fatal act of insanity while plutocracy itself teetered on a knife's edge, poised to fall into the infernal bog of self-determination the Greeks called democracy. He was a child of the law, inside and out. Born in a flatbush log cabin to a humble mob enforcer and mob enforcer's wife, he grew up with an almost biblical reverence for family, especially extended family. He was a man who held court as lord of a defunct Dutch hamlet, a man who dispatched bannermen to gentrify his fief at the business end of a billy club, a man expelled from the landed manse, financed by his subjects in the hopes he would leave them alone. By the time of the Second American Civil War, he was already a grizzled veteran. 34 tours in the Ukraine, bombardier at the Bowling Green Massacre, runner-up at the Bedminster Bedlam. But it was not until the monkey business of Manhattan that he truly revealed himself to his countrymen. For when waylaid by harriers sprung from ambush, he fought his way to safety modestly armed, with naught but his John Thomas to hand. Unchastened by phallic Pyrrhic victory, he spun his grandiloquent Sturm und Drang to rally a people to maybe certain victory. Salt of the earth people, flyover people, the same people he had cajoled a score earlier to care, however briefly, about New York fatalities. Military historians to this day cannot explain the choice of so overachieving a mind to select the high ground for his last stand in the parking lot of a gardening concern wedged between a crematorium and a purveyor of silicone orifice implements, and a Norse peyote speakeasy, a Pentecostalist clown college, an unsolvable Scientology escape room, the strip mall church of Hastur, the incomparable immolator, the ladies' auxiliary of the Knights of the Nickelback Hedjura, an oxide orange Gran Torino, abandoned in 1974, a tutoring center for octogenarians failing Marcel Proust courses at Temple University's extension program, and an Arby's, It was to be his finest hour.
Now we hear from a band with members based in both Greene County and Columbia County, the Dust Bowl Fairies. Here's their 2020 new song, Candy Store. Now on the phone, we have Columbia County Director of Public Health, Jack Mabb. Can you explain how are you? Do you have a role in vaccine distribution, or how is that going to go locally?
Yeah, I see it's the Moderna vaccine, and it's 94% effective. That's incredible. So we were given the charge by the state, by the governor and the state health department about 2 weeks ago to be ready to distribute vaccine to medical providers by the end of this month.
By the end of November?
I think it's going to happen. I think they might, Yes, by the end of November. That first wave, there's 10 to 20 million folks in the medical field in America, and that they're going to get the shots the first time. Now, there's a sort of a minimum order that has to be ordered. So, like, Columbia Memorial Hospital can order its own vaccine and have it delivered straight there, whereas local doctor's offices, dentist office, and whatever, they can't meet the minimum orders, and that's our role. So we're going to be getting vaccine, and we're going to distribute to them in order to dispense. I have seen where several pharmacies have contracted with the state health department to do vaccinations in nursing homes. I think that's going to be great. I think that we ultimately, when the vaccine's available to the general public, probably like March, April, we're going to be having what we call pods, point of distributions. We have secured a firehouse that we can do a drive-through and have several lanes of drive-through in Clawbrook. Wow. we're going to be doing community distribution through those sites. But I think there's going to be other avenues. Again, pharmacies are going to be doing it. Private doctors can do it. It's going to be just about managing that flow of the vaccine, and I think we have a role in that flow.
Do doctors need to contact you now about getting that first batch of for themselves, or are you doing all the contacting to local doctors?
We haven't contacted them yet because we haven't got the word from the state to initiate that plan. And we had to submit a plan. We drafted it. It was accepted by the state. And as soon as they give us the word that we have to kick it in, that's when we will make it clear that we will be receiving the vaccine. It appears that the first vaccine that's going to become available is the one that must be kept at like 90 below, which is a problem. We don't have the freezers in the county that go that low. It's going to be coming to us packed on dry ice. We're going to have to keep it for as long as it takes to distribute on dry ice. I believe that they say the turnaround has to be within 10 days. So it's going to be a busy 10 days for us once that hits.
Where are the nearest freezers? Is it going to be kept in Albany or in New York City? Or?
Well, it's going to be stored in Albany. A lot of this is going to be shipped directly too. So like Columbia Memorial will get theirs direct shipped.
Overnight or something?
Yeah, overnight, packed on dry ice. There's going to be a lot of dry ice used up in this country when this hits.
And do you need, I've seen the organizations or municipalities are ordering, are you going to order like some freezer, or is it on back order now because there's so many orders, or is that going to be a new problem?
Well, basically what we've been told by the state is that we have a good tight distribution plan, and we get this vaccine packed on dry ice that we can distribute it and be effective distributing it through the dry ice. We have no plans at this point to buy a freezer.
So you'll have to have, when the shipments come in, everybody will have to take get the vaccine right away before that dry ice melts, basically.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the big logistical hurdle for you, is timing it and getting just the right amount of people there at the right time.
Yes. And again, we were required to submit a plan to the state, how we're going to do it. And we think we can pull it off.
And are people going to be contacting you, or you're going to contact people to say this is your appointment, or I guess there's a priority list of, are you going to the, I guess you're going to the nursing homes first, or how is it going to, know how it's going to play out like that?
My understanding at this point is that there's a contract with pharmacies for them to send out. They're going to be hiring people, extra people to the nursing homes. And that's a big load off of us. That's not the first wave is medical people. Some of the frail elderly, I think, are in the first wave. Another 10 to 20 million vaccines become available after that first 10 to 20. Then it gets down into other workers. Most of my staff fall under category two. The folks that give the vaccination, my vaccinators, as the state calls them, they would be in priority one. And then the rest of the folks in nursing homes would be in that second wave. I'm hoping that the Moderna virus vaccine becomes available. It's not one that I think requires a deep freeze. It's a little bit more manageable. But I think by the time we get to the general public, we won't be working with that vaccine that requires a deep freeze. We'll be able to map it out a little bit in a little bit more laid back way, if you will.
It won't be so intensive for you to at first, yeah. Like if you're going to have to time 15 people being there before the dry ice melts, that's a lot more stress than come and get it when you can. And if you miss the appointment, it's not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's going to be the case come March or April when we're doing the general public.
And how long do you think it's going to take for entire Columbia County to get vaccinated?
Well, first of all, people are going to want to, you say the entire Columbia County, they're going to have to want the vaccine in the first place. And I think we were still working at 50% of the population doesn't want to get it in the first round. They want to wait and see what happens. That really doesn't help build herd immunity, protects the people that get it. Again, I think that this has never been done before in this country. We're on this maiden voyage of this thing. I can't answer the question how long it's going to take. But, you know, we have 63,000 people in the Columbia County. If 30,000 want it, that's...
Yeah, I'm more asking how fast are you capable, you know, if everybody in the county got it, how long would it take to, you know, just structurally for you guys, how long does it take to do 63,000 people?
We can do, and again, we're sort of a piece of the puzzle. We're not the only ones that are going to be doing it out there, but we practiced this at our flu vaccine clinics, our flu vaccine drive-ups. We could do 200 people an hour. You know, I know we're going to be at it all day. I mean, we're going to be at it for multiple days when the time comes. It's going to be an all-consuming thing. And I will say that I will also welcome people who would like to volunteer who have the credentials medically to be able to dispense a shot, nurses, LPNs, you know, doctors, et cetera, who would like to be part of the effort. I would glad to have them call the health department to volunteer, because I think we're going to need them.
And what percentage of the county do you need for there to be herd immunity to work? I mean, how many people percentage need to really get vaccinated for it to really work?
I've basically heard from different experts, 60 to 70%.
So, and then if somebody gets vaccinated, they're like the first wave or whatever, do they still have to wear a mask?
Well, that's going to be up to the governor, I guess. It depends on how many, I think he's going to be watching that number of numbers who have been vaccinated. And as it climbs, I think he's going to be a little bit more relaxed. Maybe you get a card or something that you can laminate it and hang it in a lanyard around your neck so that people see that you've vaccinated. This is all new stuff.
Right. That's why I'm asking, because it just came to my mind. It's like, how are you going to tell who's been vaccinated and who hasn't in June?
Yeah, it's a good question. What's the magic number for the governor to say no more masks? We don't know the answer to that yet at this point.
And can you go into a bar after 10 o'clock if you have the lanyard?
Yeah, well.
These might be the rules, right? This is all
the stuff that, you know, we could spend the rest of the morning talking through all those little scenarios, and you know, it's going to be interesting to see how it breaks.
Yeah, it's too early to really go into that. Is what you're saying?
The governor needs to make global decisions that affect, you know, the bulk of the population. If you've got 50% of your population out there who's declining the shot, I don't know whether we actually get an opportunity not to wear masks. I don't know.
We're talking with Columbia County Director of Public Health, Jack Mapp.
Oh, geez, those COVID numbers just keep going up, up, and up. See what you can do to wear a mask. I know, you know, even myself, I went running errands this week and got some of those new, better, the medical masks instead of the cloth mask. And we just gotten those in, and I put them in my bag in the car to wear those instead of the cloth mask when I ran my errands. And I got to the first errand, and it was on Warren Street in Hudson, and I ended up parking like right in front of the store where I was just picking something up. It had already been pre-ordered and everything. And I was busy listening to something in the car, not paying attention to anything at all, not thinking about the global pandemic or anything else. And I just parked in front of the store and jumped out of the car without even thinking and went to the door to pick up my package without a mask. So I know people can make mistakes, and I am admitting I made a mistake, but try not to make a mistake, because just people are getting COVID-19 over and over and over again all over the area. There's so many people are getting it, and there are continuing more and more deaths in Columbia County and Greene County and Rensselaer County and Albany County and Dutchess County and Ulster County over in Berkshire County and Delaware County and Schoharie County. Please just wear a mask. You can just do a little bit to help everybody else and help yourself. And the vaccines are on the way. We only have to maybe do it for a little while longer. If we can just all wear a mask, then the hospitals won't just be overflowing with people dying. Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We're talking with Paul Stewart, who is a co-founder of the Underground Railroad Education Center in Albany and Livingston Avenue. We're going to talk to Paul about a new exhibit they have, particularly featuring Harriet Myers. But Paul, why don't you just give us a brief introduction about, you know, what is the Underground Railroad Education Center?
Well, the Underground Railroad Education Center was founded actually as the Underground Railroad History Project in 2003. It had, as a precursor to it, several years, starting from about 2001, where we started doing walking tours to bring attention to the stories about the Underground Railroad that were connected with Albany that didn't seem to be celebrated or acknowledged in Albany in any particular way. And so we had identified about 8 or 10 stories that were associated with different locations around the downtown area. And we took groups to walk to those places and tell those stories and show images that were put together in binders that people could carry with them so that they could see some visuals of what the 19th century was like in those locations. And so there are people like Stephen Myers, Stephen and Harriet Myers, William Henry Johnson, William Topp, the Mott sisters, Lydia and Abigail Mott, and there were several others that we thought these stories were really what the Underground Railroad story in Albany was all about, and not so much about the kind of conflated, you know, and generalized stories about Harriet Tubman per se. You know, not that Harriet Tubman didn't play a role, she did, but, you know, she came through town a couple of times. You know, she had other directions that she also used to go to Canada. So the big story about the Underground Railroad was really about the local people who were involved on the front line, as well as the donors in the background. So we started the Underground Railroad Education Center to focus around that. And not long after we had started the walking tours, we did an annual conference, which has lasted for 18 years and is going into some transitions this year, though. Then shortly after that, we identified this building that really was about two steps aside of the wrecking ball, but it was a historic building where the Vigilance Committee of the Underground Railroad had met and where Stephen and Harriet Myers had lived. And so we committed to restoring that building. And right now, the Underground Railroad Education Center is housed in that building as well.
So I understand the new exhibit is primarily about Harriet Myers, but I also read that her husband, Stephen, in fact, grew up as a slave in Rensselaer County, but was freed at 18 and then, you know, married Harriet. What is the role of particularly, you know, sort of black women in the whole underground movement?
Well, what's interesting is that by and large, when people say black women in the Underground Railroad, people do think of Harriet Tubman. Maybe they think of Sojourner Truth, who also had a pretty good involvement in the Underground Railroad as well. But they usually can't get past that. They don't know who the other people are. In fact, when people talk about black involvement in the Underground Railroad, they usually think about the passengers on the Underground Railroad. They don't think about the station masters and other conductors. You know, maybe they'll think of Frederick Douglass. But there were lots and lots of people, and Frederick Douglass himself was quoted at one time as saying that, you know, the earliest leg of the Underground Railroad ran from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia, where William Still helped people, and to New York City, where Mr. Gibbs helped people, and then to Albany, where Stephen Myers helped people, Syracuse, where Jermaine Logan helped people, Rochester, where he was involved, and then to Canada. You know, so there was a train of people, and every person that he mentioned in that train was an African-American individual. And what's interesting about that is that in spite of that representation by Frederick Douglass of the Underground Railroad, when people think of the Underground Railroad, they always think of white farmers helping black fugitives from slavery, you know, or something like that, or Quakers, you know, who they presume are all white. And it's interesting because William Still was actually involved with the Quaker group in Philadelphia. He was a black man. But I understand he also went to a Baptist church at the same time. So that's kind of a...
And what were some of the risks, you know, like New York, I understand, at some point became a free state, but, you know, what were the risks to people like the Myers in terms of assisting, you know, slaves that were escaping on the railroad?
Well, you know, it's funny. I would almost make some comparisons to today in the sense that people who supported, say, you supported, say, Joe Biden and you lived out in the country somewhere and you were surrounded by Trump supporters. That's not too political. But sometimes you get harassment from folks. And that was the kind of situation, I think, that turned up a great deal that Stephen Myers and Harriet Myers and the others would have experienced. One of the things that I think was important about their situation is that although they were the cutting edge people for the Underground Railroad here in the Capital Region, they lived somewhat on what was then the periphery of town. We don't think of Arbor Hill as being the periphery of Albany right now, but back in 1857 and 1856 and 1858, when they were active in the Arbor Hill area, Arbor Hill was the periphery or the edge of Albany. And so they were a little bit out of the way, and that sort of helped. Plus, the other thing that helped was that there were a number of people in that neighborhood who were supporters and were involved directly in the Vigilance Committee, supporters of the work of the Underground Railroad. So they weren't living in a heavily hostile neighborhood as far as we could see. But it was a time when there was a great deal of division. There were slave catchers that came into New York State that the Vigilance Committee worked to oppose. It was legal for people to be captured under the Fugitive Slave Law in New York State.
Paul, we only have about 90 seconds left, so I can ask you
okay.
a two-part question. One
sure.
is... you know, how does, you know, it relate today to the Black Lives Matter movement? I understand it's one thing you guys are emphasizing. And the second, if people want more information about the center, how do they do that? In about 90 seconds.
Yeah, well, we think that the Black Lives Matter movement and all of the work that goes on today for civil rights is tied in to a continuous train of things that the black abolitionists were involved with in the 19th century, the convention movement for black rights, running people for office, crusading for voting rights. These things, when you look at what the folks were involved with back then, trying to organize food, clothing, and shelter for those who were fleeing from the fugitive slave laws, you know, organizing schools, being concerned about education, being concerned about voting rights. This was all part of the struggle then, and it's still part of the struggle now. If people want to get involved with the Underground Railroad Education Center, they can call us at 518-621-7793, or they can go to our website, which is undergroundrailroadhistory.org, and there's plenty of information there about how to get in touch. There's a webmail mailer that you can use to jot a message in and send it to us, and we usually respond within a day.
We're out of time. Paul Stewart, the Underground Railroad Education Center, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Good day, all. This is Michelle Masurgeon for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, and my guest today is Melanie Trimble with the Capital Region Chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Welcome, Melanie.
Thank you.
So the Albany chapter of the NYCLU has been advocating for meaningful civilian oversight of police agencies in Albany and Schenectady to address serious, persistent allegations of police misconduct and corruption. And back in August this year, Albany implemented a policing reform and reinvention collaborative in response to the executive order from the governor, and the policing reform collaborative has been tasked with compiling recommendations to go to the Albany Common Council of April of next year. In the meantime, the Albany Common Council has come up with some of its own proposed legislation, and I wanted to capture your thoughts on the proposed legislation, the pros and cons. So could we start with Local Law H, which requires a gathering and reporting of statistics?
Right. Well, we're very pleased that the city is taking the directive from the governor seriously and really rethinking the police department. But a lot of these proposals don't really have a robust look at how to police to really protect the community and be a part of it. Local Law H requires the reporting of, it's very important. Data collection is key in being able to rein in a department and take a really long, hard look at what they're actually doing. But it doesn't include warning citations and arrests. So we're a little concerned about little minutia within that law to not be as broadly interpreted as possible. So instead of just traffic violations, what if you're just walking down the street? It's not a traffic violation, but you get stopped by the police. We would like that to be included in the statute.
So the next local law is the implementation of using city-owned body or dashboard cameras by the police, and also reporting when the cameras are turned off.
Right. Our concern with body cameras, and we did work with Albany's police department on its creation of its body camera policy. The biggest problem with body camera footage is who's entitled to see the footage. And unfortunately, in most cases, police departments are in complete control of the footage, and it is rarely released to the public. I mean, it really depends upon the temperament of the police chief who makes those decisions, and those circumstances can change if personnel changes. So we'd like to see it memorialized in any legislation that the public has access to things that are recorded on the body cameras. And also there are other departments around the Capital Region that don't have very strong body camera policies. It's imperative that the officers turn them on, do not have control of turning them off until the stop is completed. And, you know, to respect people's privacy, of course, there are times, say, during a domestic violence incident where the camera shouldn't be turned on. But those things are very discreetly outlined in camera policies. And we'd like to make sure that not only Albany's policy, but the policies of other police departments in the Capital Region.
Okay, and the third was Local Law J, which really is enhancing the Community Police Review Board in the City of Albany, their authority and ability to exercise oversight, review, and resolution of community complaints, basically creating a more meaningful citizen review.
Yeah, there are really some good ideal models out there for citizen police review boards, and almost all of them include subpoena power, and we're very happy to hear that the Common Council is seriously considering granting that ability for the board to independently issue subpoenas, because right now they have the power to issue them, but with the permission of the Common Council. And again, political circumstances could change. The council met now may be very willing to issue subpoenas in a police situation that really warrants it. However, the politics can change. And so we want it memorialized in the chapter, in the legislation that controls the Citizens Police Review Board, that they do have independent investigations and subpoena power. The other thing is they really need an independent counsel. I don't think that that's included in Local Law J. And that is essential for the Citizens Police Review Board to have independence from the police department when making legal decisions. And right now, the Citizens Police Review Board has to rely on the same attorneys that serve the police department. That's not going to work.
You know. And I understand sometimes it's even difficult for the Community Police Review Board, even when they ask for information, to get it released from the police. It could be like they kind of have to jump through hoops.
Well, part of the shielding was involved with 50A, which is state legislation that shielded police officers from having their personnel records looked at. And that often has impeded the Citizen Police Review Board's ability to make sure the police officers aren't continually doing bad things and without any kind of recourse on the police department. We need to know as a public what's happening with disciplinary records within the department. And we're very pleased with the repeal of 50A to start to really work with the courts and the police departments to get as much information out to the public as is necessary for them to have oversight over the police departments that control their very lives. We're very excited. We actually have begun to send in FOIL requests to many police departments in the area. In our area, we're looking at Troy Police, at Schenectady Police, and at the State Police. So we're hoping to get a full, robust collection of personnel records out of them. We'd like to have the courts enter into it and make decisions about what the limits will be on that. That's in particular the Schenectady lawsuit. So we'll see what happens with the release of 50A information. And also, I think it will help the police review board deliver and deliberate in a better manner to serve the public.
There was a November 10th symposium through the New York Writers Institute, and when asked about systemic racism, Troy Police Chief Brian Owens said that, quote, "We don't have systemic racism in the Troy Police Department," unquote. So how do you think communities can come together to make improvements and reform when those in law enforcement reject the idea of systemic racism in law enforcement?
Well, and that's exactly why most police departments, hopefully the Troy Police Department will follow suit, are conducting audits to look at the data that they already have and see if, in fact, it's indicating that discriminatory arrests are being made, or that at least show us how many and what's happening in our neighborhood are people of color being involved in the criminal justice system at a much higher rate than the white population in cities that where their demographics don't indicate that that's fair. So one thing is data collection. I don't know. I mean, the Albany Police Department in its audit has fallen short of being able to even provide the data that the auditors can analyze. We're very concerned that the Troy Police Department isn't keeping records that are sufficient to do that kind of analysis well. Without that, the claim that there is no bias in the police department is just an empty statement, because we don't have the data to show whether or not a police department is targeting people of color, right, unnecessarily. So data collection is key. Everybody should look at the STAT Act. We've been trying to get that passed in New York State for a long time. It will require police departments to collect the type of data that the public needs to see in order to know how well they're performing in the communities they serve.
So we're kind of running out of time here. Is there anything else that you would like to see included in any of these police reform proposals? Is there anything missing?
Well, we have a mission statement that's on our website that I would recommend people go to. It's got a lot of points in it about what true police reform would look like. And that's working with the community to, you know, be able to really have established trust among the people that the police are serving, and to really kind of de-escalate the militarization of our police departments and make them more humanistic and more responsive to the community. And so you can go to our website, nyclu.org, just look under policing, and you can find our mission statement there on police reform.
Okay, I hate to do this, but I have to wrap up. And I thank you very much, Melanie, for being with me today, and stay safe.
Yes, stay safe and healthy.
Okay, thank you. Right. And this is Michelle Masurgeon for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
So we're losing physical proximity, obviously, through computer technology. Anything else?
I think we're losing intimacy. You can only love somebody that you know well. The average father in the U.S. spends less than 30 seconds communicating with his own children.
So we're losing physical communities. Anything else?
Anonymity, particularly in cyberspace, where you feel like you can get away with almost anything, from the family on up to the nation state.
So we're losing chat rooms and online salons and communication. Anything else?
Well, the capacity for self-deception, or what we might call interest groups. And I don't think those are communities.
So we're losing what the internet is promoting, and cyber libertarianism. Anything else?
I think that the internet does promote sitting alone instantly, becoming absolute to reality. Do you have a grasp of reality, the way things really are in the world? Deadly. We need to spend as much time seeking all other ways of knowing.
So we're losing physical wisdom. Anything else?
I think our relationships are weaker, and I think the search for God is important. And I think ultimate reality still is important in the world today. And I think the best past that gives us some light on the future is that we are so connected to the continuity with the significant technologies around where we eat. It's very interesting. Where we come together, where we take our time, that's the way it's going to be, and we're going to get to know one another again. And in fact, I think life is a big mistake. I put intimacy with God in the discussion so he can protect people who feel that they love one another because we're not looking at reality. That's the way it's going to be. Especially those things that were funny.
So we're losing computer technology. Anything else?
He's come for good. He'll never come back now, even though he said he would. So darling, dry your eyes. So many other guys would give the world, I'm sure, to wear the shoes he wore. Oh, come on, smile a little smile for me, Rosemary. Where's the use in crying? In a little while you'll see, Rosemary, you must keep on trying. I know that it hurt you bad. I know, darling, don't be sad and smile a little smile for me. Rosemary, Rosemary. I guess you're lonely now. Love's coming to an end. But darling, only now are you free to start again. Lift up your pretty chin. Don't let those tears begin. You're a big girl now, and you'll pull through somehow. Oh, come on, smile a little smile for me. Rosemary, where's the use in crying? In a little while you'll see. Rosemary, you must keep on trying. I know that it hurt you bad. I know, darling, don't be sad and smile a little smile for me. Rosemary, Rosemary.
Brand new Yola Tenga.
Hello. We are extremely pleased that you are here.
Forever.
It is good to come together for the purpose of co-creating. Do you agree?
Just like that.
You're knowing what you are wanting?
No memory whatsoever.
Hello.
It is an expanding thing, yes.
Hello.
And that's good, yes.
Hello. Hello. Can you hear me?
Well, here's what it says.
It's beginning to rival people.
This is what it says.
It is beginning to rival people.
This is what it says.
Can you hear me?
Well, here's what it says. The pulse. Like.
Can you hear me?
The pulse that is erratic and irregular. The pulse.
Hi, this is Rodney Greenblatt from Catskill, and you're listening to WGXC, ACRA, 90.7 FM.
Jan Gabarek, Egberto Gismonte, and Charlie Hayden recorded a memorable live jazz performance in 1981, but the tape sat for over 30 years before being released. We'll hear a long track from that album on the next Deep Threes, along with music from Moondog, Paco Rozic, and Bash Nova. Deep Threes. Where will the music take you?
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable. All the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Meredith Coy of Atlanta, Georgia. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, November the 20th, 2020. I'm Mike Clifford. A partial recount of Wisconsin votes in the presidential race begins today. It comes amid repeated election fraud claims from President Trump, despite those claims going unfounded.
President Trump requested a ballot recount in Milwaukee and Dane counties, both of which are considered more liberal. Milwaukee County also is home to the state's largest number of black residents at nearly 27%. Greg Lewis of the group Souls to the Poll says after all the outreach work that was done in the middle of a pandemic, it's difficult to see a recount with such a narrow focus.
It's very disrespectful for someone to come along and really cast a shadow and cast doubt over where everything that is done in this community has been legitimate.
He says black Wisconsinites also had to overcome the state's restrictive voting laws. Milwaukee's Democratic mayor echoed the sentiments, calling the recount effort an attack on minorities. The Trump campaign paid a $3 million fee for the recount, while asserting that a number of absentee ballots in these counties were illegally altered and issued. I'm Mike Moen.
The recounts must be completed by December 1st. President-elect Joe Biden won in Wisconsin by more than 20,000 votes. As policymakers gear up to write a state budget for the next 2 years, a new report has suggestions on how to expand health care coverage to more families in the state of Connecticut. Tiffany Donaldson is the CEO of the Connecticut Health Foundation.
The group is 13% of the Connecticut population, but yet they represent 26% of those who are uninsured in our state.
The group of people who are uninsured includes about 48,000 folks who make between $17,600 and $25,000 a year. With COVID cases rising again in New York, nurses in one of the early hotspots say conditions at their hospitals are unsafe, and they're threatening a 2-day strike on December the 1st.
Nurses at Montefiore Hospital in New Rochelle have been negotiating for a contract for more than 2 years. At a rally outside the hospital on Thursday, nurses said they want wages that are up to regional standards and to hire more nurses to ensure adequate staffing levels, including in intensive care. Michelle Gonzalez, a nurse on the negotiating team, says it takes 4 months to train an ICU nurse, but hospital management only wants to train helpers.
We are not asking for helpers. We have very clearly demanded that we need staff that is ICU trained and ICU prepared.
I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
This is PNS. Tomorrow is National Adoption Day, which celebrates forever families and highlights those kids still waiting to find homes.
Throughout the month of November, Illinoisans are being encouraged to share their connections to adoption by displaying coloring sheets in their windows created with their kids and sharing pictures on social media. Allison Katzenberg works in the Illinois Department of Child and Family Services Quincy Field Office. She says COVID-19 has definitely affected the ability to connect foster children with forever families.
Some adoptions have been delayed because of COVID. Courthouses have been closed. Attorneys and people involved have been quarantined or positive for COVID. Foster families are a little more reserved. They don't want to expose their family.
Tomorrow is National Adoption Day, when many courthouses around the state typically hold ceremonies celebrating the finalization of adoptions. Some of those events have been moved online. Mary Sherman reporting.
The Gila and San Francisco rivers in southwest New Mexico have been central to the state's history and their designation as wild and scenic.
The research shows water-related outdoor recreation in the area supports thousands of jobs, which provide $92 million of income. Grant County Commissioner Alicia Edwards has seen firsthand what the rivers provide.
It stimulates activity that is responsible for 4,000 or more jobs in this area, and that is huge. And they're jobs that are probably primarily small businesses.
The M.H. Dutch Salmon Greater Gila Wild and Scenic River Act is currently before the U.S. Senate. I'm Roz Brown.
And finally, Diane Bernard tells us West Virginia is on track to meet requirements handed down by the Department of Justice last year to move more foster kids with mental health issues out of institutions in favor of community-based health care.
Cammy Chapman with the state's Department of Health and Human Resources notes her agency is working with groups as part of the DOJ agreement to have no more than 712 foster children with serious emotional disorders in residential treatment facilities by the end of 2024. Chapman expects the state to reach that goal.
As of October 31st, 2020, our number for kids that are in a residential mental health treatment facility that are foster care children placed in DHHR custody was 822. So we are on target.
She points out the number of referrals of foster children has dropped during the COVID-19 crisis while schools are closed, and acknowledges the number of children in institutions might rise when schools open again. I'm Diane Bernard.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported on interesting radio stations across the nation and viewed now on Free Speech TV.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Grant. The Daily Freeman is reporting the 10 counties located in the mid and lower Hudson Valley gained a combined 22,000 non-farm jobs in October, continuing to recover from some of the losses caused by the coronavirus-related economic slump, according to the State Department of Labor. The region-wide total at the end of October was 942,600, up from 920,600 in September, but still sharply lower than the 1.03 million total of a year ago. Non-farm employment includes all positions in the private and public sectors, with the exception of those in agriculture. The Labor Department said there was a slight increase in the non-farm job totals in Greene and Columbia counties from September to October. Greene County's total rose from 14,000 to 14,200, while Columbia's climbed from 20,000 in September to 20,500 in October. The October 2019 totals in the two counties were 14,700 in Greene and 21,800 in Columbia. Similar increases were reported in Dutchess, Putnam, and Ulster counties. Statewide, non-farm employment increased as well. The state unemployment rate last month was 9.6%, a small improvement over the September rate of 9.7%, but still much higher than the October 2019 rate of 3.9%. And you can read the full story in the Daily Freeman. Natasha Vaughn is reporting for Columbia Green Media. Basilica Hudson has announced its annual farm and flea holiday market will be virtual this year. The market has been an annual event for the past 8 years. Due to COVID-19 concerns, holding the traditional in-person event was not possible. So the market will include more than 70 Hudson Valley-based businesses selling goods and services online. Melissa Off-DeMar, Basilica Hudson co-founder and director, said in a statement, and I quote, "This pandemic is hitting hard on our cultural and social livelihoods, so sticking together locally and putting our creative minds together is how we will get through this challenging time," end quote. Shoppers can choose items from local and regional vendors offering handmade items, crafts, unique food options, and more. The vendors include a variety of farmers, artisans, local chefs, vintage collectors, and more. Basilica Farm and Flea was awarded a $5,000 grant by the Hudson Tourism Board. Those funds were used to create the website that links seller sites and to support educational workshops and promotion of local businesses. Basilica Farm and Flea holds two markets each year in the spring on Mother's Day weekend and the holiday market after Thanksgiving. The virtual market can be found at basilicahudson.org. And you can read the full story at hudsonvalley360.com. Mid-Hudson News is reporting the Dutchess County Legislature's Budget, Finance, and Personnel Committee, November 19th, approved the county's proposed $502 million 2021 budget. By a vote of 9-3, lawmakers adopted the plan, which includes funding for law enforcement, parks, and COVID-19 relief. The committee cut $18 million in spending. The full legislature will vote December 3rd on the proposal. If adopted, the spending plan will mark the sixth consecutive year of lower taxes for county residents. Committee Chairman William Truitt said, and I quote, "Because of the work done by this legislative body over the past few years, under the leadership of Chairman of the Legislature Greg Pulver, and in partnership with County Executive Mark Molinaro, we may have one of the only counties in the state able to say we managed to cut taxes for the sixth year in a row while still securing funding for essential services during this pandemic. I'm proud of the budget we've created and am confident it will pass with flying colors in the legislature in December," end quote. And you can read the full story at MidHudsonNews.com. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, November 20th. 40s on the thermometers across the board this morning, with a seasonably nice day in store. As the day goes on, cloud cover drops and temperatures rise to 57 degrees at 2 p.m. Winds will be brisk, reaching 10 miles per hour, so be sure to bring a jacket and don't forget those sunglasses. Overnight, it's relatively mild, reaching 41 degrees before dawn tomorrow. Another seasonably nice day with a high of 52 and a light breeze. Sunday will start around 30 and make it to 43 in the afternoon with a side of light rain. The next high tides will be at 7 a.m. and at 7:17 p.m. this evening. Low tides will be at 1:02 a.m. and at 1:11 p.m. Sunset today will be at 4:16 and sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:54 a.m. Looking way up, we see two near-Earth objects are expected today, the largest of which is 38 meters wide, pretty much a harmless rock. Solar wind speed is currently 375 kilometers per second at 5.7 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3. Quiet. The current sunspot number is 11, and this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
90.7 FM.
Acre, Hudson, Catskill.
I'm sitting here wondering if this matchbox will hold my dreams. The redhead in my arms go up in flames, will dissolve mighty regimes with her screams. So it seems. She dragged my face from the eye to my lip on the rough side of the striking strip to the port side of a sinking ship, staring at a compact mirror, the siren calling from another era. While you made faces and then blew kisses, drowned in a pool that hypnotized Narcissus. Say I have a perfect face for radio, and a trumpet for listening, a cheek to turn to you, an eye for glistening. Tear that tear from me, hold it in your memory. Pull away the powder and the pain-painted dream of this and that disgrace. A silver band of marching souls, a button of brass, an epaulet of gold. That Lenten light, that slight fanfare that consoles. That trivial, sniveling rosary, that ring-a-ding rosemary, condemned a man, alas, at last at Requiem Mass. Sound much better than I look, like a hero in a book. Now there is too much at stake. But perhaps you mistook my mistake for the tip in the print you dusted for from the hand you forgot to shake. Tumbledown Dick said to King Oliver, I don't shrink down at the thought of you. Give the people back their ringlet prince, just like you ought to do. Journey far from here like Gulliver to lands at the edge of everywhere that we have still to discover, where there's a soul of a jackboot in a broken brace, poised above a human face, forever and ever. Just doesn't matter if I should deceive you or if I should flatter. If your bankroll gets thin while some kitty gets fatter, radio is everything. From the straight to the narrow, to the broadcast from within, radio is everything. Radio is everything.
On November 3rd, President Donald Trump was asked to remove himself from his place of residence. That request came from the American people. Deep down, he knew they were right. But a crippling fear of inadequacy would never allow him to acknowledge defeat.
We did win this election.
When incoming President Joe Biden took up residence on January 20th, he found his desk occupied by a sloppy orange goblin.
Let's do that over. He's coughing in the middle of my answer.
Yeah. Donald Trump is a disaster.
He was always known as a dummy, and now he's a dummy and a half.
Can two old men live together in the White House without driving each other crazy?
Will you shut up, man? Listen, this is a fraud.
The Fraud Couple. Thursdays at 9:30 on ABC.
Next, we hear from Madhur Maktur, who just signed with Matador Records and has his first single out on the new label, Chismitten, 2020 new music from Madhur Maktur.
We'll be right back.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
The Transgender Day of Remembrance has been observed annually on November 20th as a day to memorialize those who have been murdered as a result of transphobia. Today, we are joined by Justice Dazzle to talk about the Transgender Day of Remembrance and its observance here locally. Justice, welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you so much. That's great to be here.
And Justice, you are with Schenectady Safe Space. Can you tell us about this organization and what you do?
We started just about a year ago, actually, in November of 2019. I had recently moved to Schenectady from Albany. I hadn't realized that there wasn't a Pride Center here in Schenectady. And so I reached out to a few different LGBT friends here in Schenectady and seeing if they'd be interested in trying to get our own Pride Center going. So over the last year, we have we've held a few events, although really only one in person, because the first event we held was in early February, and then the world shut down in early March. So basically, our focus is on having it be a safe space for everyone, as well as making it a fully accessible space, so that, you know, a teenager can come with their parents, somebody with autism, or those types of sensory issues can come, and it's not like there's going to be a space where they can go, you know. So even if we're having a loud event, there's a space where they can go. Having it be physically accessible so that people with physical disabilities don't feel like they're kind of shut to the side or they can't go. And we partnered with Schenectady Pride to do a virtual / socially distanced Pride at the end of June, and we have started in May. We have been doing a virtual, it was going to be in person, LGBT and questioning support group. It initially was once a month, and we have moved that because of response. We've moved that to twice a month. So it is the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 6:30 to 8 p.m.
Great. You are collaborating again with the Schenectady Pride to hold a vigil to mark Transgender Day of Remembrance this coming Friday, November 20th. Before you tell us about that event, can you first tell us why it is important to have this day?
So the thing is like, New York is one of the safest places to be trans, mostly because, you know, New York passed a law called GENDA, which basically says that me being trans isn't a reason for me or my landlords to kick me out. I can't be fired for my gender identity. I am allowed to use the bathroom, no matter where it is, in the state that matches my gender identity, and I don't have to approve that to anybody or any of that type of thing. Whereas a lot of other places, that's not the case. New York is also only one of only 11 states that has banned the use of trans panic defense in court, which basically is you find out someone that you were interacting with, whether it was romantically, sexually, or just in your day-to-day life, is trans or gay, and you react violently, whether, you know, it's just assault or whether it's murder. And in 39 states, that is a valid legal defense that can potentially get the entire case thrown out, and you get no repercussions for your actions. You know, so what that leads to is a lot of trans people, primarily trans people of color, and the vast majority, trans women, black trans women, get murdered. This year, the last count I saw was there were 35. Up until this point, which is more than any other year since it's being tracked. You know, the most recent one I'm aware of was a woman who was walking home from work in Indiana, and she was brutally murdered. And that was less than a month ago. You know, and this was a white woman in the middle of Indiana who worked at a local store and had to walk less than a mile home. And, you know, and that's just the people that were actually identified. as being trans. A lot of times family